And I think there are two key changes pertaining to the power of the monarchy that are worth stressing for the later 17th century. The first of these is a simple expansion of the bureaucracy. By European standards, the English state ran on an absolutely skeleton staff in the early 17th century. But the later 17th century would see a huge expansion of the royal bureaucracy and also a professionalization of the royal bureaucracy. By 1720, it has been calculated, there were fully 10 times as many civil servants as there had been in 1640. So the simple personnel apparatus of the English state is much more robust, much bigger, stronger, and more professional by the early 18th century than it had been 100 years earlier. The second key element in the increase of the power of the crown is financial, which is perhaps mundane at this point, but nonetheless significant. The customs and excise revenues continue the upward pattern begun in the reign of Charles II. New taxes would also be subsequently added. In 1692, a land tax was introduced, and that soon became the main source of direct taxation in England. What is interesting about all of these taxes, and I suppose it's, the administrative history is somewhat less than fascinating, is that in comparative perspective, they soon turn England into one of the most heavily taxed countries in all of Europe. Whereas in 1640, the burden of taxation in England on a per capita basis was one of the lowest in all of Europe, by the year 1700, per capita taxes in England were twice as high as they were in France. So England goes from being a state with a minimal bureaucratic apparatus and very low taxes to being a state with a large bureaucratic apparatus and very high taxes. What is interesting is that not only do the crown's taxes also increase dramatically, but its borrowing increases dramatically as well, often driven by the need for war. The crown's borrowing was nonetheless placed on a much firmer footing by the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. A lot of people think of the creation of the Bank of England as having something to do with the establishment of accounts for the little people. No, it's actually a way of financing the borrowings of the crown. The foundation of the Bank of England in 1694 made the king's debts, formally speaking, the national debt, underwritten by Parliament and secured by parliamentary taxes. And the greater security of the national debt made people much more willing to lend money to the crown. Indeed, William and Anne would be able to borrow on a much vaster scale than any previous monarch. And here we see a pattern which we've already seen earlier in the Habsburg Netherlands, that in those parts of Europe where the state is able to establish some kind of a system whereby people can lend money to it with confidence, it's possible for European states to borrow an awful lot more money. And of course we know where that money goes. It goes to wars. And this brings us to the wars that England fought in the later 17th century as well. These two changes in the English state, which I've stressed, the expansion of the bureaucracy and the improvement of the crown's finances, really resulted less from the constitutional settlements of the late 1680s and early 1690s per se, than really more the fiscal demands of the long and very expensive wars into which William and Anne plunged England. Between 1689 and 1713, England would be almost constantly at war with France, and the size of the English army rose from just 10,000 in 1689 to 76,000 in the 1690s to fully 93,000 troops by the 1710s. And it was in these wars of the late 17th and early 18th century that England finally again became a major European and imperial power. England had not been an important military power on the European continent really since the 15th century. By the early 18th century, it was again a power which was able to fight full-scale land wars on the continent, and indeed it was able to win full-scale land wars on the continent against other major powers like France. At the same time, however, it should be stressed that these fiscal changes gave Parliament unprecedented power to control the activities of the royal government. In the first place, the fact that the Crown depended on parliamentary taxation for wartime expenditure forced the Crown to concede that the land tax, this major source of direct taxation, should be administered largely by the people who paid it. So this land tax ended up being administered largely by the landed gentry. Second of all, the need for Parliament to be able to guarantee the national debt would force the Crown to allow Parliament to audit the Crown's finances. And so the finances of the monarchy were now open to public scrutiny, at least by Parliament, on a much greater scale than had ever been the case. To sum it up, in other words, it seems to me that we can say that by 1700, the English Crown was financially much stronger than it had ever been before. But it was stronger in a way that also made it heavily dependent upon those people who counted, the political nation represented in Parliament. As the historian J.C.D. Clarke has put it, it would appear that the constitutional agonizings over monarchy had concerned not so much the power of the monarchy per se as an institution as the uses to which that power would be put. Once the key issues had been taken off the table, especially the issues of religion, Parliament was willing to entrust the crown with enormously more power than had ever been possible in the past.